Amen. If you're here this morning, I want to welcome you and thank you for coming to our class. And after the sermon on time, those sermons always make me real nervous because not only do I have to try to figure out how to use my time right before the Lord, but I have a gift from each of you right now of some time in your life that's very precious. You could be spending this time watching TV. And I read Dr. Tim Elmore's book, The IY Generation. Did you know, according to at least one study he cites, children who are graduating from high school today watch 35 movies for every book they read? Stunning. So you could be watching a movie. Instead, you are here, and I want to thank you, but I especially want you to recognize that all of you are special. All of you are important to be here. God knows every one of you by name. But there are a couple of unusual guests for us that I'm aware of that I want to make sure y'all are aware of so you have a chance to meet them and greet them beyond just the group that was right around them in the greeting. So down here we have Dr. Jim Hoffmeyer and his wife Kathy. I'm going to be bold and ask you to stand up, Jim, so that they can see you. An Egyptologist who spoke at the library last night, a wonderful man, and has talked to him. He's... other than the fact that he has Dale Hearn's sense of humor, and he's just absolutely delightful gentleman. No, it makes him delightful. Next to him is Lawson Younger, Younger Lawson, a man with two last names or two first names, depending on how you do it. Would you stand up for us, please, Lawson? This gentleman, if you've got any cuneiform or Akkadian that you need translated, he'll do it on site right here for free. Next to him is Dr. Bill Schneidewin from UCLA. Bill, you got to stand up. And he is a world-renowned linguistic fellow also, and he'll be able to tell you whether or not Lawson got the Akkadian right. And somewhere in here, I'm not seeing them over here because they've got to leave early. We've got some Bible professors from Lubbock Christian who are here. Where's John Lawler? He should be. John and his wife, Mary Ellen, are back at the Coffee and Donuts. But they've been here before, and they are here this morning. We're honored to have some of these incredible, world-renowned academicians here. Brent Sandy is here somewhere, too. I just realized... yes, there's Brent. Thank you, Brent. Brent, and he's next to the Lawlers. Brent and his wife, Kat Cheryl, and Mary Ellen and John Lawler. Brent will be teaching at Wheaton this fall if you happen to be enrolled there. But I found out as I'm getting up to teach on the prophets this morning, which means I didn't change that cover slide, did I? As I'm getting up to speak on the prophets this morning, he, among others in this group, have published on the prophets. So we'll have people grading our paper, and maybe we'll do okay. I can't pass up what Dr. Fleming talked about in his opening and everyone else, because I started writing this lesson on Thursday in terms of typing it. I'd done the research before, but I'm typing it out, and I'm thinking, well, if the world's going to end Saturday night, what's the point? Yeah, I mean, I don't need to do the handout. And then if it doesn't, I could say to y'all, well, I'm sorry. I didn't think, you know, I thought Saturday night, I didn't expect all of y'all to miss the rapture. And so I've got it in my introduction because we're talking about prophets, false prophets, real prophets. But I do it a little bit different because you put up with me in my PowerPoint. So I'll tell you that this is not just a normal prophecy from some unusual person. The guy who's predicted this actually has a radio network of over 140 radio stations. They bought billboards. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end they of bought the world things as we for know it. Park benches, it's bus stops. They put out pamphlets and brochures, billboards galore. Now, some of you aren't REM fans, and some of you are a little bit older, so I tried to reach back and redo that slide for you children of the 60s. Don't say no, it's the end of the world when you don't. Yeah,
we have to fade out. When you don't love me anymore doesn't really fit, but that's the way Herman's Hermit sang it, so we had to throw it in there. Yes, this is the fella, Harold Camping, Family Radio Network. He made his bold, it wasn't a prediction, it was a statement of confidence, a statement of faith. He interviewed over it. I looked at the interview. In the New York Magazine interview, he was asked this question: how certain are you that the world's going to end on May 21st? Do you have any doubts? To which he replied, God has given so much information in the Bible about this, and so many proofs and so many signs that we know it is absolutely going to happen without any question at all. They pressed him. They said, well, describe to me exactly what you expect to happen on May 21st. This is what was supposed to go down. When we get to May 21st on the calendar, in any city or country in the world, there's going to be this tremendous earthquake that's going to make the last earthquake in Japan seem like nothing in comparison. And then the earthquake will follow the sun around for 24 hours. As each area of the world gets to the point of 6 p.m. on May 21st, it will happen there. It's kind of like the wave, you know, in a stadium. Earthquakes start at 6 o'clock, and they just kind of roll around the globe as 6 o'clock hit. So at 6:01, we were eating dinner last night, and we all looked at each other and said, well, surely one of us would have made it if it had happened. Then we realized he probably didn't take into account daylight savings time. So we were thinking, because Arizona, you know, doesn't honor it. So it could have been like, you could have, the rapture, if you'd been standing on the border, according to this guy's theory, with 1 foot in Arizona and 1 foot in Nevada, or New Mexico, let's go closer to home. 1 foot in New Mexico, when half of you could have been raptured. Half of you would have had to wait. It would have been a tough 60 minutes for that body. Now, this is not the only fellow who's out there who can tell you what's coming around the corner. Miss Cleo is making a lot of money doing this. You can get the first 7 minutes free. The problem is she doesn't give you that much until minute number 8. She's on pay-per-view. I don't know how someone does that on pay-per-view. I mean, I just don't get it. But they're out there. So my question to you is, do these people that we're seeing today, are these examples of what the biblical prophets maybe at least would have seemed like in their day? Did someone laugh off Amos or Jeremiah or Isaiah? He's like Miss Cleo. That's that camping fellow. Or was there something different within biblical prophets? I think there was. And I'd like to talk to you this morning in an introduction. Now, we're going through the Old Testament chronologically of sorts. And we're in the divided monarchy. And we've been doing this through the books of Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings in our English Bibles. And so in the process of this, we're actually starting to reach the times where the prophets begin, what scholars will call the literary prophets start. The prophets who have books that either contain their words or were written by them or written in reference to them or something of that nature. But we're going to try and integrate those prophetic words within the chronology of Kings, if that makes any sense. So that's what we're trying to start doing today. And the prophets don't just start in Kings, but if we were to put the biblical prophets on a bell curve, and we were to try and figure out what occurrences are the meat of the bell, where do the prophets really start making their major appearance in the Old Testament, it's going to basically be with the rise of the monarchy and even into the post-exilic period. Now, that's not to say that there weren't prophets afterwards. That's not to say that there weren't prophets before. But we're in the part of Kings where the writer of Kings itself could almost change. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, we've got some idea of Kings as a book of prophets, because prophets take center stage in much of this. And I say you had some before. The first reference to a prophet is actually a reference to Abraham. Way back in the book of Genesis, Abimelech's taken Abraham's wife Sarah as a bride because Abraham was too afraid to stand up for her.
And God comes to Abimelech and says to him, you better return the guy's wife. He's a prophet. You return it, return Sarah. He'll pray for you and you will live. If you don't return her, you're going to die. And so Abraham is called a prophet. It's the first reference to a prophet in the Hebrew Old Testament. He's someone who's going to intercede on behalf of Abimelech. Not just Abraham, but as we continue to go through the Old Testament, Moses is a prophet of prophets. He's someone who truly takes the word of God, not just orally, but physically on those tablets to the people. And so you have Moses as a prophet, but as direct as Moses was a prophet, and he was a direct prophet. You know, in addition to Moses, his brother Aaron, his sister Miriam, they're a prophet and prophetess. But when they're belly aching about their status compared to Moses, God has some pretty harsh words for him. Says, hey, you may be a prophet, you may be a prophetess, but I do not even remotely speak to you as directly as I do Moses. Moses is the supreme prophet. He is the lawgiver. He is the one who speaks forth for God into the nation of Israel in the way that the nation takes with them, practicing Jews even today. So you've got Moses. But even with Moses, this is actually a passage out of Exodus. You can tell I didn't get a lot of that sleep last night. On PowerPoint, I need to tweak. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you. And so Moses himself is saying there is going to come another prophet like me from among you. But he sure wasn't there at the time. Now, there were still some wonderful prophets. And as we move through the judges, we see Deborah was a prophetess. And there are little sparks of prophets here and there and here and there. But by the time we get to Saul and the monarchy, Samuel is the reigning judge. Their judges didn't reign in the sense that they had one judge over they had territorial judges as leaders and all of this. But Samuel is the big guy. Okay, he's the one that anoints Saul as king. Saul himself, for a period of time, enjoys this stint as a prophet. There are prophets around Saul. There are prophets around Samuel. You start seeing the rise of a number of prophets. And in fact, in reference to Samuel, we have this passage. We're going to clarify our Hebrew terms for a minute. Enough. The servant answered Saul, here, I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver. I'll give it to the man of God to tell us our way. They'd lost some property. They'd lost some donkeys. Now, the writer here says, formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he said, come, let us go to the seer. For today's prophet was formerly called a seer. And Saul said to his servant, well said, come, let's go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. Here are three different words used in the Old Testament for someone who's a prophet, who's speaking on behalf of God. A man of God, a prophet, or a seer. And so we've got those different words, we've got those different terms, we can pull those out of the text and we can look at them and we can examine people who had this responsibility and see what they did. Now, there is a distinction in our Hebrew terms for a seer, for a prophet, for a man of God, and the Hebrew term for a diviner. A diviner is someone who uses some type of an incantation, a formula, or something to dictate, in essence, the message that needs to come forth. In other words, can order the gods to respond, can order the divine to give the message, can read the sign within the liver of the dead animal, can do something where it it's God is not a tool for a prophet any more than God is a tool for us. And God is not a diviner. Now, that's not to say there weren't diviners in the Bible. Heavens, Joseph pretended to be one to his brothers. He talked about the cup that was stolen and said, that's the cup I use for divination. Got his brothers all worried at that point. They didn't know he was Joseph. So, but in terms of what Israel was taught, one of the diviners was Balaam. You remember Balaam of Beor, the guy with the donkey who gets called? You know, the Israelites are going through and they're creating quite a fuss. You remember the story? They're creating the fuss and King Balak says, we're in trouble. We need to call down a curse on these people. Go get Balaam, the son of Beor, and bring him in and let him call down the curse for us. And so Moab, living in fear, has their king send messengers to get Balaam, the son of Beor, and says, now, would you please come curse these Israelites? Now, one of the fun things we've got here is these archaeology gurus. And if I ceded the stage for a moment, they would want to come up here and tell you about something really cool that happened in 1967. In 1967, archaeologists were digging at Deir Allah. And it's a dig that is, if we were to put it on a map, the Dead Sea is south and Sea of Galilee is up north. They're connected through the valley with the Jordan River. And one of the branches of the Jordan River in Genesis talk is called the Jabbok River. And that's what you've got there. This is just a little bit north of the Jabbok River right there. And it is an area that at times would have been occupied by Israelites, but at other times not. So there's the town, and that's what they're digging in, and they're really excited about it. And as they're doing the dig, they find some little busted chips of plaster, and they realize there's writing on the plaster. And they're dating this plaster ultimately around 700 to 800, probably 800 BC or so. And this is pretty cool stuff. I mean, the dig basically shuts down. All anybody cares about is the plaster. The plaster is not the kind of thing you water down to clean up because it's plaster. It doesn't do well with water. So they're trying to get all of these chips together, and they're trying to put together what it is that they have found there. And so as they put it together, they find, whoops, we're going backwards, let's go forwards. As they put it together, they find these pieces that help them cobble together a text. And they don't have all of the text, but they've got enough to keep folks like these guys down here busy for years and years. They have conferences and seminars where different people present different views of what letters are missing and how it might be. And it's a fascinating thing just to start looking at some of it. But what's most interesting and what caught their eye immediately and captivated them is here in this inscription, it talks about Balaam, the son of Beor. And this is an inscription that is taken from the book of Balaam that somebody just wrote on their plaster wall. So you've got an actual book. And of course, these guys out there digging know their Old Testament enough to know Numbers 22 or Numbers 20 or 22, wherever it is, it's in that range, where it gives the story of Balaam, son of Beor. And here's an actual text where what they can figure out at least indicates it's the same Balaam, son of Beor, who's being talked about as a diviner or a seer. And talked about as someone with this ability to curse. The gods came to him at night. He beheld a vision in accordance with El's utterance. Then said to Balaam, son of Beor, so will it be done with naught surviving. I mean, a guy's got an ability to call down a curse. But that is a different situation than what the Bible is dealing with. Though that's a really cool find in archaeology and the way it ties into Scripture. And it also indicates to us something else. As we read the Bible in its historical context, we need to understand Madam Cleo is not simply a 21st century phenomena. They had tons of people claiming to have insight into the divine, tons of people claiming to be able to speak on behalf of the gods. There's an artist reconstruction of a town off the Euphrates River, an ancient city called Mari. It's a Sumerian city, and when it was being dug and excavated in the 20th century, they found, I think, over 25,000 tablets.
something like 25,000 tablets. Now, I have, this is obviously some artist's reconstruction. I have no pictures of what this town might have looked like. But I can tell you that the tablets that they've recovered can be read by a couple of these guys down here. In fact, one of them has, Lawson Younger, has published a number of translations of these. Am I correct? Yeah. He says, yeah, go buy this book, buy this set. They're published by Brill, and Brill sells really cheap books. So there are 25,000 or so of these tablets that they found. And these tablets are written in a language called Akkadian. And these tablets have fascinating curses. They have fascinating stories of prophets. They have fascinating, the kings, Zimri Lee, I think, is one of them, who's one of the kings where a lot of the tablets are. And it would be fascinating. Here's a book by a fellow named Wolfgang Hempel who comments on these things, and not just comments on them, but gives a number of different translations. And it's fascinating to me that 1,000 years before this time in Israel's history, prophets are already writing down their prophetic words, and they're being kept for posterity. And you read the prophecies, in some ways they have all these little phrases that are repeated over and over and over again. It's a fascinating read, but the kings are looking for counsel, they're looking for advice, they're invoking blessings, they're invoking curses. Prophets existed in that day and age because people wanted to hear. You know, there is in all of us this hunger to hear something beyond what's coming out of these gray cells. And so that's what you have. So now, if we go back, when Israel has this occurrence of prophets, even back Abraham on, it's not unusual for them. We've already heard a number of them. Nathan was David's prophet, principal court prophet, it seems. It was Nathan who came to David and said, you've committed sin with Bathsheba, child's going to die, God's upset, you need to repent, blah, blah, blah. Of course, he didn't come that boldly and say it. He started out with the story of the other fella who had the family sheep and blah. You know the story. Gad, another prophet, goes to David and announces God's three options on the curses for David's census that he performed wrongly. We've already talked about Ahijah, the prophet, who's the one that went to Jeroboam, had his cloak torn, said, you get 10 pieces of the kingdom. Judah will keep 2. Rehoboam would keep 2. Ahijah's the same one that later on announced the death of Jeroboam's son, or that his son would not recover. You have the man of God, the unnamed man of God, who's called the man of God right up till the time he disobeys God, and then he's just called a prophet. But you have that man of God who comes to Jeroboam and says, hey, you did not choose to follow God. You've chosen idolatry, and its curses will come with you. You've got Jehu, the prophet, who goes to Baasha and tells him the problems he's going to have. You've got countless prophets that were killed by Jezebel, prophets of Yahweh. So you've got this massive rise of prophecy as an important part of the history of Israel during this time. And I want to add, we talked about Elijah last week, or Stephen did in my stead while I was gone. By the way, we do need to talk about Elijah for just a moment, because you are Hebrew students now and you're learning your Hebrew alphabet. So Elijah, I want you to help me guess what this name means. The E-L part. Who's going to help me? God. Very good. Now, the I makes it personal. Eli, I is just means my, okay? So we've got my God. Yah is an abbreviation for Yahweh. Very good. So here you've got this prophet whose name, my God is Yahweh, standing against the prophets whose God is Baal. And we talked about, or Stephen talked about that last week. Yahweh is my God, defeats the prophets of Baal. And it was a great story. But eventually Elijah goes, and then you get to another prophet called Micaiah. Now, Micaiah is a great prophetic story. It's found in 1 Kings chapter 22. And to understand it, you've got Judah in the south. Let's see, we'll make this a little bit bigger. You've got Judah in the south. You've got Israel, Samaria in the north. You've got, and these are your mountains. You've got your Plateau of Benjamin. You've got your mountains. You've got your Dead Sea. You've got your Jordan River. Galilee's up here. Okay, you with me? Now, Israel's having fights up here, over across, up even further, off the map. But those fights are also coming down into this range as well. So Israel, you've got that highway that runs from Egypt to the Euphrates going on that side of the Jordan River. So Israel at this point in time says, I got to go fight, but I'd like the king of Judah to go with me. I want to join forces to go do this battle. So they get together and they start to do it. For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war. But in the third year, the king of Judah, whose name is Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah came down to the king of Israel, came down even though he was going north, because he came down off of Jerusalem, came down to the king of Israel. The king of Israel said to his servants, hey, you know, Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us, but they've taken it from us, and we need to go take it back. Will you go with me? Can we join forces and go take this? And the king of Israel, Jehoshaphat, says, hey, my horses are your horses. You know, yeah, my people, they're your people. You want to fight? I'll fight. I'll be on your side. We're together. He says, great, let's go take them on. Jehoshaphat says, well, not so quick. Now, they may be your people, but we don't want to lead your people, our mind, to slaughter. So Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, inquire first for the word of the Lord. So the king of Israel gathers the prophets together, 400 men, says, shall I go to battle against Ramoth-Gilead or shall I refrain? And they said, knowing that he's already called all the army out because he wants to go to battle, it doesn't take Miss Cleo to know the answer to what the king wants to hear. They said, oh yeah, man, go for it. God's given it to you. You will win that. But Jehoshaphat said, you got anybody else? Because I'd be real interested in another prophet of the Lord, of whom we may inquire. Now, we're reading English. We don't have the benefit of reading the Hebrew, but you know, because we've been in this together too long now, you know that when Lord is spelled this way, it's a different Hebrew word than when it's spelled this way, right? Well, spelled, that's not the right way. When it's capitalized. In other words, uppercase L with lowercase ORD is the Hebrew word Adonai, a general word for Lord. Uppercase L, uppercase but smaller ORD is Yahweh. So now let's fill in this with a little bit more clarity and we see why it happened the way it did. Jehoshaphat says, inquire first of a word from Yahweh. So the king of Israel, well, they've been killing all the prophets of Yahweh. He doesn't have a bunch of those around, and they're not reliable anyway. So Ahab, the king of Israel, this is the guy married to Jezebel, remember, okay? King of Israel gathered the prophets together, 400 men, said, shall I go to battle or shall I refrain? They said, go up for Adonai. They're not speaking for Yahweh. They're not prophets of Yahweh. They're prophets of Baal, Lord Baal. We'll give it to the hand of the king. Jehoshaphat says, time out. Surely somewhere you got a prophet of Yahweh. I'd like to hear what Yahweh has to say about it. The king of Israel said, well, there's this one guy by whom we may be inquire of Yahweh. His name's Micaiah, the son of Imlah, but I hate him. He never prophesies good concerning me, but evil. Are we really going to have to go there? I got 400 over here. And Jehoshaphat says, oh, don't say that. Say it ain't so. So the king of Israel summons an officer, says, well, hurry up and go get this guy. And in comes Micaiah. Micaiah says, yeah, you're going to lose. Don't do it. And the king of Israel says, you're a fake, a fraud, a phony. Lock him up, and then I'll deal with him when I get back. Doesn't happen. Ahab got killed in battle. The prophet was right. So you've got Micaiah as a prophet of Yahweh, speaking on behalf of Yahweh. And it's an interesting story because it poses a question that raises in my mind, at least. I think to some degree, some people thought that prophets don't simply speak the future, but could make the future. I think you see in some of these texts, and I'm not a scholar on this, so this is just linear speculation. Please don't act like this is true. But I see it also with some people today. There are some people who think simply because someone says something, it's going to happen. That there are people who have that kind of control. And they can make your future for you. And so the kings wanted prophets who were going to say what they wanted to happen. They weren't simply looking for that magic eight ball to tell them what would happen. So you've got those stories. And you've got not just with Micaiah, but Elisha becomes the prophet of note and a lot of narrative after Elijah. And if you go to another story that's a very similar story, yet very different in its effect, in 2 Kings chapter 3, in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, is now king over Israel. And he reigns for 12 years. And during this period of time, the king of Moab, which is a kingdom directly across the Jordan River, the kingdom of Moab is ruled by a king named Mesha. He was a sheep breeder. See, I mean, he went to the top land as a sheep breeder. I mean, anyway, he had to deliver to the king of Israel all of these lambs and rams. This was the ransom because they were under the thumb of Israel at the time. So he quit doing it because, Ahab's dead. He's thinking, now's the time to break away. Let's see if the boy has what it takes to follow in his dad's footsteps. Not to mention the fact, when dads died and left the kingdom to their sons, sometimes there was internal bickering over whether or not Junior even should be king. A good time to rebel if you're a vassal state. So Ahab dies, the king of Moab rebels against the king of Israel. So Jehoram, King Jehoram, marches out of Samaria and he gets all of Israel together and he sends word down to Jehoshaphat like dad did and said, the king of Moab's rebelling. Will you come help me battle against Moab? And Jehoshaphat says, I will go. I am as you are. Mi casa es su casa. Me people are your people. My horses are your horses. Which way you want to go? He says, let's go by way of wilderness of Edom. So they go out. They start marching all around. They make this circuitous route. They've run out of water. They're thirsty. The animals are thirsty. Things are going bad. So then the king of Israel says, alas, Yahweh, he's at least speaking the speak. Yahweh has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. And Jehoshaphat said, don't you have a prophet of Yahweh here through whom we may inquire of Yahweh? Let's try and find the will of God in this. So one of Israel's servants said, well, there's Elisha. He's the guy who poured water on the hands of Elijah. Jehoshaphat said, the word of Yahweh is with him, so they go down and get him. So Elijah says now to the king of Israel, what do I have to do with you? Why don't you go to the prophets of your father and your mother? King of Israel said, no, 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 no. I've got Jehoshaphat with me, and he's a Yahwist. It's Yahweh who's called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. You know, what should happen? And Elisha says, well, actually, this is going to turn out pretty good. There's going to be this flash flood. It's going to bring water down here. You're going to have water, and you're going to win this battle. And it happens. And it's a wonderful thing. And the kings of Israel, or the king of Israel and the king of Judah, press the battle forward, or at least the king of Israel does, and continues to smite Moab until the king of Moab takes his own drastic action. Here's the way the Bible records it, and then I'll show you how the king of Moab recorded it. When the king of Moab saw the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but they couldn't. Then he took his oldest son. The king of Edom was the third king who joined the other two. That's why they went via the way of Edom. Sorry, I'd left that out. Then he took his oldest son, who was supposed to reign in his place, and offered him for a burnt offering on the wall. There came great wrath against Israel, and Israel withdrew from him and returned to their own land. Now, we don't know great wrath upon Israel. Does that mean that the troops were so galvanized by this sacrifice of the king and this perception of his god Chemosh's help at this point that they just really got that surge and fought? Does this mean that the Israelites were so appalled that they lost heart and they left? We don't know the details, but we know factually, historically, that Israel withdrew. It's interesting to me to look at how the king of Moab lays the story out. And we talked about, I've got a picture on the PowerPoint, if we can go back to that briefly. We talked about the Mesha Stela, King Mesha of Moab. It's also called the Moabite Stone. We talked about it a few weeks ago. It's actually, you can read a good translation of it in the Hallow Younger book, but the Stela actually has it this way. This is what the Moabite king wrote. The king of Israel had built Jahaz and stayed there during his campaigns against me, and Chemosh, who is the god that Moab and Mesha worshipped, drove him away before my face. And so the same historical story is recorded there, though from the Moab perspective. You'll also be noticing as we continue this march through history, we have lots and lots and lots of growing different historical sources to help us understand and contextualize Scripture on this. So that's what happens. And that happened from Elisha. So Elisha is the kind of prophet. We have stories of him helping the king of Israel. We have stories of him helping the king of Judah. We have stories of Elisha giving money, oil. Same thing. Then, now. Money, oil. There's a destitute widow who's going to lose her kids. And so what he does, yeah, there's a money, oil guy who deals in trading oil. Same thing as money. Gary's laughing. This is the same thing, just a little different oil. It was olive oil, but it was kind of like fill the jugs up. They'll have unending oil through this miracle transformation, and go sell the oil, and that'll help you keep your children from going into slavery in response for your husband's debts that he didn't take care of before he died on you. That's what happened. Not only that, we have Elisha helping a woman from Shunem, a Shunammite woman. Elijah had been staying with her, and she was grieving. She had no kid. She gets him. He prophesies she'll have a son. She indeed has a son. The son falls ill. The son dies. Elisha used by God to raise him from the dead. Elisha also helps foreigners. Foreigners come to him, and Naaman. A foreign general has leprosy, sends to Elisha. Elisha says, go dip in the Jordan 7 times. He says, hey, don't we have our own rivers that are a whole lot cleaner than the Jordan? And his servant says, hey, look, if he'd asked you to climb a wall, would you have done it? If he asked you to do something tough, would you have done it? All he did is say, dip in the Jordan 7 times. So he dips and he dips and he dip, and he came up clean, as the song goes if you're in third grade. So, Elisha is able to work with him. And not only that, but there is a servant named Hazael of the king. And a servant of the king, the foreign king, Ben-Hadad, comes in. And he's on there for some message.
And Elisha sends back word, my king is sick, is he going to live? Elisha sends back word that basically says, if you read it carefully in between the lines, well, he would live if you weren't going to kill him. And Hazael goes back and assassinates the king and becomes the king. Not only did Elisha say that, but in saying it to Hazael, Elisha's weeping because he foresees all of the trouble Hazael, his king, is going to cause to Israel and all of the outrageous things he's going to do. And it happens, and Hazael becomes king. By the way, we were looking for it. Where did you decide it is, Younger? Is it in Istanbul or Berlin? We think it's in Istanbul. He thinks it's in Istanbul, and I'm going with him on it. There is a basalt statue of Shalmaneser the third. I've heard it both ways. Of Shalmaneser the third. And it's got a reference. You can read the translation here, page 270. Here, we'll put your book up here so everybody on the internet can see how important it is to buy this book. When the sales of this book goes through the roof, you're going to say, man, at Lanier class, they are good for book sales. This is the Asher Basalt Statute, a summary or display. Let's see if you can still read it. A summary or display inscription incised on the front, left hip, and back of a broken basalt statue of Shalmaneser the third. Hang on. It was discovered in the 1903 German excavation, blah, 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 blah. Here's what it says. Hadadezer, and that's Ben-Hadad in biblical terms, Hadad Edri, passed away. Yeah, he was killed by Hazael, his servant, or as this statute says, son of a nobody. I just love the fact that, 3,000 years ago, he's son of a nobody. So the son of a nobody becomes king. They have the wars, they have the fights, they have the battles. And sure enough, in one of them, someone gets hurt. The king of Israel is hurt, and he retreats back to Jezreel to lick his wounds and where his mama is so that his mama, Queen Jezebel, can take care of him because he got all hurt in battle. And so this is the story I call J-cubed. This is the story of Jehu, Joram, and Jezebel. So Jehu comes in and prophesies to Joram and says, bad news. You're not going to do well. You're not going to make it. The battle. Joram goes back, and he's resting up in Jezreel when this chariot comes down the road. Chariot coming. Who is it? We think it's Jehu. Why? He's driving crazy. I don't make this stuff up. They can tell by the way this guy, he's bobbing and weaving on the road. And so, does anybody, is the army with him? No. All right. So the king goes out and says, how does it go? Is it peaceful? How's life out there? And Jehu's response to any news of peace is, your mother's a witch and a whore. Now, I cringe typing that. This is a church. But the English Standard Version says it. She's a sorceress and goes whoring. So I figure I can take the participle down to the noun. Your mother's a witch and a whore. At which point the wounded king realizes this is probably not the kind of meeting I ought to be in. And he turns his chariot around and starts, get the gate open, I'm coming back in. But before he can, Jehu lets the arrow fly, kills him. Jehu goes in, looks for Jezebel. Jezebel hears the problems. She gets on her finery, her makeup,
She does her hair. I mean, it says it. She puts on her makeup and does her hair. And she comes and she looks out the window as Yehu comes up. And she comes and she looks out the window and just starts tearing the guy up verbally. I mean, it's a massive verbal assault. To which Yehu responds and says, okay, hey, servants up there, are you with the whoring witch or are you on my side? They look down at him. He's got the army. He's got the city. He's killed the king. All they've got is Jezebel with her makeup and hair. So they say, we'll show you. And they push her out the window. She falls. Dogs come lick up her blood. She's dead, exactly as had been prophesied about her. So this is what you've got. Now, these prophets that we've been dealing with up to this point in time are what are called non-literary prophets, because we don't have them in writing like we do the literary prophets. But in the last few minutes of class, I want us to take the stories we've looked at and ask ourselves, what do we know about the role of prophets? Are they simply the guys on the radio that are going to tell you the world's ending, or the woman on DirecTV that's going to take your money in return for telling you something that's probably, hey, you don't have to pay her. This is the kind of stuff. Some of you are hungry. I'm sensing out there some of you are going to be eating lunch soon. Okay? Some of you are wondering when he's going to finish. I want to speak the future into you. 7 minutes. Prophets are intercessors. Don't go to Miss Cleo and give her money to pray to the Lord for you and intercede on your behalf. Prophets from as early as Abraham, Moses, how many times did he intercede for his people? Nathan's interceding for David and the people. I mean, the prophets are interceding with God on behalf of those in need. The prophets are speaking God's place in history. And history I'm using in a funny way. I'm using it in the sense of the past and the present and the future. The Israelite religion, the Christian faith, one of the things that makes it stand out significantly from its contemporary religions is they very much were nature-based. But the Israelite faith was historically based. These prophets are not standing up and they're not reading liver omens. They're not standing up and making determinations by nature signs and invoking gods of nature, the gods of the thunderstorms or the gods of the rains or the gods of the fertility for the crops and the animals. They're not doing that. They're standing up speaking of the God who intervened in the historical lives of their forefathers and foremothers. They're standing up and saying, the God who brought you out of Egypt, the God who gave you his word and his law, the God you made covenant with, the God who told you not to have any other gods in front of him, this, they speak of a God tied to history, not tied to nature. Because they're speaking into the history of the present. They're speaking into the lives of the people. They're ministering and calling for social justice. They're calling down the implications of the historical acting God into the current situation with a projection as to what the future will hold. And it's not always a definite future. So, you know, Ahijah says to Jeroboam, you got two roads in front of you. You follow God and follow God alone, and your house will be like Beit David. You'll be like the house of David. You don't. And you'll be destroyed just like the kingdom's being torn from Rehoboam. I mean, that prophet gave him two optional futures. But the prophets are speaking in, and they're speaking in not because they've got God on a magic string and God in a magic box and they've just got this innate ability to proclaim the word of the Lord. No, they're speaking because they've been compelled by God to speak. God controls the prophets. The prophets do not control God. And so that's what we have as the role of prophets. And as we start looking at them, these things will become clearer and clearer to us. So put it aside
and see these prophets for what they are. The prophets served as the conscience for the king. They served as the conscience for the nation. That's what they were. Harold Camping, he is no prophet. And as a practical matter, if you look at how he figured out it was going to end last night, he did it based on the Exodus. And he thought that happened in 1447 BC. And if you were at Jim Hoffmeyer's lecture last night, you know it didn't happen until Ramesses II, which was in the 1200s, or in our class where we taught that about a year ago. And so, you know, maybe he's 200 years off. But I do want to say this. Deuteronomy 18:22 says, when a prophet speaks in the name of Yahweh, if the word does not come to pass or true, then it's a word that Yahweh never spoke. The prophet spoken presumptuously on his own. Don't be afraid of that prophet. In fact, stone him. And nothing personal, Harold. What I'm driving at is this. This whole thing that happened yesterday, it discredits Camping. It does not discredit the Lord. Now, does it leave us with a bit of a black eye, us being the believing church? Yeah, it's embarrassing. And the only way we trump that is by affirming our faith and affirming in whom we trust. And more importantly than what we say, living it. And so we go to our points for home. The king of Israel went to his house vexed and sullen. I don't remember if Stephen covered that story or not, but it was a story where Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard and Ahab couldn't get it because Naboth wouldn't sell it to him. So Ahab goes into full pout mode at home. And Jezebel, his wife, why are you pouting? Oh, I can't get my vineyard. I wanted my vineyard. I can't get it. He won't sell it to me. Well, you're the king, whiny pants. Let me just kill him for you. And she goes, hey, kill Naboth so I can have his vineyard. My husband's birthday's coming up and I need to give him something. And so, you know, here's the point. Chasing idols is destructive. Now, you think about idols for a moment. And let's don't define them as little creatures made out of clay or something. Paul talks about your God being your appetite in Philippians. Let me suggest, my little sister gave me this definition one time, and I think it's wonderful. An idol is something that you chase after rather than chasing after God. Something that you chase after more than you'll chase after God. Something you care about more than you care about God. Something that preoccupies your mind and attention and drive and desire more than God does. And if you do that, it's destructive. Not simply because it'll leave you vexed and sullen, it will lead you to sin. We want our desires to be simply for God first. I love the way Pastor David talked about it. It's not your time that you need to be careful with. It's the time God gave you. In the time he gave me. Second point for home. The king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 of them. False prophets, real prophets. We'll be talking about that more as we go through this. How do you tell the difference? What is the difference? I want to tell you two things about this that really strike me. Number one, there is something in all of us that almost wants to be so special and wants everything to be on our terms. We would love to get a special word from the Lord, or we would love to be able to give the special word from the Lord, or we would love to be able to get. I told you about my friend in college who decided she had the gift of prophecy. And so years later, when we were expecting Will, before sonograms would tell us what the gender was, she came and proclaimed the prophetic word of the Lord over what his gender was. And I just remember thinking, well, you got a 50-50 shot. You know, and all she was doing, she didn't know if she had the gift of prophecy. She was experimenting to see. Well, don't experiment at a 50-50 shot. Pick the lottery numbers. Then I'm going to believe you. But we want that. And the reason we want that is because there is a gnawing inability for many of us to be satisfied with seeking God on his terms instead of ours. We would love to seek God on our terms. I would love to call in God to do what I want him to do when I want him to do it. I would love God to give me that special word, give me that special insight, give me that special ability. When what I need to do is say, here I am today in Houston, Texas, on May the whatever day it is, 22nd, 2011,
on God's terms. What am I to do for him? Lord, reveal your will to me. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, not mine. We need to seek God on his terms. And if he gives you a gift of prophecy, praise the Lord, use it wisely. But if he doesn't, don't feel like you left out. He gave you what you need to do what he has put before you to do. Last point. Moses said, Moses, the supreme intercessor, Moses, the supreme prophet, Moses, the one who carried the words of God and delivered them to the people, Moses, the supreme judge, Moses, the supreme mouthpiece, Moses, who led the people, said, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. John and others record Jesus and others recognizing that Jesus is that prophet. Jesus is Messiah as prophet, priest, and king. As prophet, he's not just Moses. He's Moses plus. Moses gave you the law through Christ, grace and truth. The law may be true, but grace and truth through Christ. You know, Moses is an inferior prophet compared to Jesus. And so we praise the Messiah prophet, because there's the prophet that's truly interceded. There's the prophet that's truly speaking into our past, our present, and our future. There's the prophet who is speaking social justice into our lives, who's taking the law of God, the heart of God, and applying it to our circumstances. There's the prophet who's meeting our needs, and that's our Savior. Let's pray together. Lord, would you please, please, please help us to do your will. Help us to seek your will. Help us to find your to-do list. Help us to do your to-do list. Give us the wisdom. Give us the tools. Give us the strength. Give us the resources to do the wonderful things you've given specifically for us to do. We've got a lot of young people in here, Lord. I pray that every one of them will get from your spirit a sense of the purpose you have in their life. And while the world is flashing in every video, in every TV station, in every peer interaction, while the world is flashing diversions in their eyes, I pray that your heart will draw them straight into your will for them. And that all of us will encourage and exhort each other in that. I pray through your Son, Jesus, this blessing on us all. Amen. Review your Hebrew alphabet. We only have 6 letters left. We're going to do 3 more next week, God willing. Thank you, guys.